my barometer is different than some people. So to me, like a C property that's kind of beat up, I'm like, this isn't bad. I actually bought a property. We just sold it actually this month, but I bought it 2 years ago and then the inspector was out there and I met him out there and he said, man, this is a rough property. And it was like 11 in the morning. I said, has anybody shot at you today? He was like, what are you talking about? I'm like, has anybody shot a gun at you? And he's like, no. And I'm like, think you're fine, man.
Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings, the number one show about growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. Now, here's your host, Mark Allen Kenny.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings. I'm Mark Allen Kenny. Our guest today is Devin Elder. How are you doing today, Devin?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on, Mark.
Awesome. Thank you for being here. Devin is a San Antonio native and sole owner of DJE Texas Management Group, which has successfully completed over 200 real estate renovation projects since 2012. DJE currently has ownership interest in over 1,400 units of multifamily in Central Texas, valued at over $130 million. Devin is also the host of the DJE Podcast, a weekly show interviewing the top commercial real estate experts in the world. Devin, I'm super excited to have you here today. Could you tell the listener just a little bit more about your background and how you got started in real estate?
Yeah, absolutely, Mark. I went to college, got a bachelor's degree, and started in the corporate world. Worked for two of San Antonio's largest employers for a number of years. And I started off really, really with a lot of steam in that. But after a few years, the shine started to wear off. And I'm also kind of naturally predisposed towards entrepreneurship. So I was just not happy in a corporate environment. And I realized I never would be. And that was kind of a lightning bolt aha moment for me when I realized that I'm an entrepreneur, whether that's genetic or whatever, I can't do it another way. So I started looking for vehicles, spent a lot of time and a lot of trial and error there, and finally discovered real estate. But by the time I discovered real estate, I'd already fully committed to figuring out how to become an entrepreneur. So that helped. You know, the early years were exceptionally difficult getting it up and started, kind of breaking out of that orbit of the corporate world. But my goal was to get out of the corporate world and go build a bunch of wealth in real estate. And that's what happened.
That's awesome. So how did you actually, once you kind of went through that period of trial and error, focused on real estate, how did you dive in and what did your first deal and strategy look like?
You know, this is a path that I took and I see it work for a lot of people. You know, the first one was that I paid for some education. That was my first real estate investment dollar, was paying for education. It was a decent amount of money too. Then right after that, I bought a single family house with that education and kind of a network that I built. And I did the BRRRR model, which people might be familiar with. It's buy, renovate, refinance, rent, and repeat. So I did that and I really liked it. I said, hey, I'm committed to building passive income here and a business that I can eventually support myself on. I bought a house. I did it. I refinanced it. I got a renter in there. It's cash flowing. It's got equity. It worked. I mean, it wasn't like, it was certainly scary, but it worked. So once that one house worked, I went and did about 10 more of those just like that. And I was all consumed, you know, and this is while having a young family and while working full time, et cetera. You know, I was burning the candle at both ends for about 2.5 years there. And I mean, I would meet the title company runner at Starbucks to do a closing and then zip back to work. And I'd go check on houses before and after work. And I was completely obsessed with it. I even changed jobs to get an easier job so that I could focus on real estate and have less stress, and took a pay cut because all it was about was getting to this financial freedom through real estate. I remember my boss in my last job, who's a fantastic guy, you know, talking about kind of career path stuff. What's your next move here? And I was like, I'm good. I like my job. But kind of like an odd answer, like, well, you seem like a motivated guy, but I wouldn't even go to lunch with people from work because I didn't want that negative energy and people complaining about work. I'm like, I'm going to go sit at the counter by myself and listen to a podcast and eat lunch. And I did that for years, you know. I mean, every day driving to work, driving back from work, eating lunch by myself. So I didn't have that negative energy from work. And it was very difficult to break out of that orbit, but I was 100% committed to it. So I was doing the rental houses. Fortunately, through this mentor group that I initially started, I got to meet some really fantastic people who I'm still friends with to this day, who were doing large multifamily deals, you know, 200-300 unit deals. And at the time, I just couldn't even ever imagine doing that, but it definitely planted the seed. You know, I realized it took a lot of capital. And so my goal was, you know, number one, to build some passive income so I could leave corporate. And number two, build up the amount of capital and network and experience to go do these big multifamily deals. And so I was very fortunate in that I got to meet people and see a path forward years before I ever did it. You know, it's got to exist in the mind first, and then you've got to convince yourself that you can do it second, and then you go do it. And for me, that process took years to go through both the process of learning it and convincing myself I could do it, and then building up the capital alongside it. And it took both of those. So while I was busy doing all these single family deals and running around like a crazy person, I was also fortunate to befriend some people that were already doing the big stuff. And it wasn't so much that they had these pearls of wisdom that were I couldn't find anywhere else. Because now, you know, the knowledge is kind of ubiquitous, right? I mean, you can go figure out how to, what debt service coverage ratio is, or, you know, listen to podcasts and kind of learn the mechanics of it. It was really more about just being friends with somebody, and that made it, somebody was doing it, and that made it real for me. Thinking, gosh, you know, this person was an engineer or whatever, and now they own 1,000 doors of multifamily. And it just, that made me believe I could do it, right? And so that was really, really important. So the goal was always multifamily. I spent a lot of years flipped a lot of houses. And eventually, as the capital started to grow and my experience started to grow, and especially when I was able to leave my corporate job, that freed up a lot of time and energy to get into multifamily. And then it's just kind of grown since then.
Yeah, that's awesome. I really like what you're saying. There's that saying that you're the average of the five people that you hang out with the most. And it makes a lot of sense that you're kind of, you chose to put some distance between you and your negative coworkers, and then seek out that mentor program and surround yourself with people doing bigger things. So that's awesome. How did you, once you had the idea that maybe that was possible for you and maybe you could expand beyond single family homes, how did you make that first jump to a larger apartment complex? And what did that larger deal look like? And then also on the capital side, did you raise money, or were you using your own capital from the single family house flips you were doing, or what did that first deal look like?
Yeah, I took a really organic approach. You know, I had done all these houses, and my first multifamily was 6 units. I mean, it was just barely multifamily, but I bought it with my own capital and the bank. And this bank, and I developed a relationship with a bank on some single family stuff. So I said, and really, this 6 unit was like, it was like $30,000 a door or something. It was basically the price of a house. So I was like, I could do this, you know, and I don't need investors. And I ran it myself. I mean, I was out there signing leases on Sunday morning, right? So, and it was a rougher part of town. It was pretty far from my house and all that stuff. So it was, I wanted to at least transition into multifamily on my own without capital, because I was not comfortable raising capital. And then from there, and that turned out to be a very successful investment. It just, not a great time return. You know, the numbers made sense, but it's such a small amount of money. It didn't make sense. The next project was 75 units where I partnered. I co-GP'd with some people and we did all the asset management. It was this huge turnaround project. And then the project after that, kind of having done the 6 unit and then partnered really on the operations side. I mean, really day, I was basically going into the office every day and we were managing this property. It was really intense turnaround war zone property. And so after I'd done that, there was 130 units I identified that I was able to go out and buy myself as the primary GP. I had one other partner help out with the balance sheet and liquidity and raise some capital, but I was basically, this was my deal now, 130 units for me to run, make all the decisions on. And so that's how I did it. You know, 6 unit by myself, no partners, a 75 unit where I did raise some capital. I think I probably raised, I mean, on a $2+ million capital raise, I probably raised $500,000 of it. And then the next deal, you know, was a $2.5 million capital raise, and I raised a little over half of that. And so it was kind of, you know, looking back, it was kind of an organic growth there, you know. And now we can go do our own deals and raise all our own capital. And it's like, we're like an established company now. So, you know, we're kind of up and running and off to the races. But that was how I made that transition out of single family.
Yeah, that's awesome. That makes a lot of sense. So I noticed on your website that you're doing a few different things still. You're investing in land. You've got some development projects, multifamily, of course. Are you still doing single family houses as well?
No, that's like my least favorite investment.
Sure.
If somebody came to me with like a really, well, honestly, I don't even want to mess with houses. I'm starting to get my kids I'm starting to give some of my rentals to my kids and teach them what a P&L and a balance sheet is and cash flow and stuff. So my plan is to give, we have a handful of rentals still in the portfolio. My plan is just transition it to them. And by the time they're teenagers, they can kind of run numbers on that stuff. And if they want to run with that, they've got some great backing. But if not, then that's fine. But that's kind of my only involvement in single family. We got some flip projects that we're finishing, some single family development projects we're finishing. And after that, it's just not worth the time and energy.
Sure. Makes sense. So what is your strategy moving forward? Is it just 100% on larger apartment complexes?
Yeah, I think that's going to be it. You know, there's some one-off projects here and there, but really the plan is kind of unfolding as I envisioned it a few years ago. And that is to buy a handful of deals a year in my market and to be a key principal and a passive investor on lots of other deals. You know, I've built some great relationships with other operators and people in the business over the years through going to conferences and the podcast and here locally, or sometimes some of our investors in our deals, you know, they want to move up and sponsor a deal. And so I'll help them with that. So my goal is to, you know, my day job is to come to work. We have a small team and we own the management company, which is a much bigger team now, is just to come to work and buy, you know, three or four deals a year on our own and then invest capital in other people's deals and be a key principal in other people's deals. And that to me feels like it's pretty scalable and we can do that for kind of a long time into the future. So that, you know, we'll take it a year at a time, but that to me feels like the path forward is passively investing and running a handful of our own deals that we can acquire, you know, a few a year on.
What markets are you focused on these days?
Just San Antonio.
Okay. Nice. And I didn't realize you had in-house property management. So you're kind of vertically integrated. You have construction management and the whole team, huh?
Yeah. We did that this year. And it's not something that I would have guessed we would have done, but just had some painful experiences with third party. And not to say that third party management is always a bad move. I think if you're starting out, it's probably a better move because you want to rely on that expertise. But at some point, you know, we had enough revenue. You know, I'm looking at the numbers going, we have a pain point with these third-party management companies on a couple of deals. And then we have all this revenue that was going out every month. And I just said, you know, hey, I'm just going to write a check and start a new company. And hopefully it can pay me back at some point. And hopefully it can work. And so I was willing to just kind of take a risk and start it up. And it really hinged around one person that I was able to bring on the team. You know, somebody I had a relationship with that was an outstanding regional manager. So now he runs my property management company. And it's pretty cool. I'm extremely happy with the level of efficiency we're able to have and the level of, you know, instead of trying to get through some bureaucracy in some company that runs 3,000 units, I go next door in my office and ask them a question, right? So I really like that. And I like, I like growing the team there. And I think we can grow some careers for some people. And that's rewarding. And it's not me running the day-to-day because I really don't have the capability to run a management company. But I can own one, you know, and we can put them on all our properties. And I've been extremely pleased with that.
Is there a asset class or kind of business model that you gravitate towards as a company? I'm sure it's changed since those first few properties that it sounded like they were heavier lift value adds, maybe C-class properties.
Yeah, I still like C-class stuff. I mean, I like 1970s stuff. And I think maybe it's just like my barometer is different than some people. I mean, I've done stuff where like, you basically are like, you know, getting shot at. So that's kind of my low point. So to me, like, a C property that's kind of beat up, I'm like, this isn't bad. I actually bought a property. We just sold it actually this month, but I bought it 2 years ago and then the inspector was out there and I met him out there and he said, man, this is a rough property. And it was like 11 in the morning. I said, has anybody shot at you today? He was like, what are you talking about? I'm like, has anybody shot a gun at you? And he's like, no. And I'm like, think you're fine, man. Just because we got some deferred maintenance over here. We got some down units. Like, that's par for the course, man. So I think because I've had some rough experiences, you know, a beat up 70s property that needs a lot of work is like, I don't know. It doesn't concern me as much maybe as other folks. Now, look, you're going to have higher OPEX and higher CAPEX and there's more risk there, stuff, all that stuff, right? But I'm comfortable with it. So, but yeah, if I have my choice, I definitely, we've trended towards bigger, fuller, and newer. You know what I mean? We bought a property last year that's basically half Class A. And I'm like, man, the revenue is really strong on this property. It's really clean. It looks good. It's almost a property you would kind of brag about to people. Whereas a lot of my properties, you know, historically, it's like not something you would say, hey, look at this. We own this. It's, you know what I mean? So I've kind of had that experience with the newer stuff and it's nice. It's just harder to, it's harder to make those pencil. So our strategy is, we're looking at a 5-year hold, 15 to 20% average annualized return to investors. What can we do for that? You know, if that means it's a 95% occupied and we can do minor tweaks over a hold period and we get a really good interest rate and we can hit 15% average annualized return, great, we'll do it. So my only criteria really is, 100 plus units in San Antonio. And then the numbers. And if it's 100 plus units in San Antonio and it hits our numbers, I'll buy it.
Yeah. And I'm guessing you're syndicating most of these deals. Is there a minimum investment amount?
We've played around with it. I mean, we've done as high as 75, as low as 25. I think it just depends on the, we're usually doing 506B offerings. So we've got a limitation on non-accredited investors. So we're closing a deal next week though that we did a little over $3 million raise on a 506B and it was a 25K minimum. Because we've got a lot of people we meet. We do networking events in San Antonio and people want to kind of dip their toe in multifamily. And it's totally understandable they don't want to commit 100K, first go. And we've got really good systems and software set up to say, hey, whether it's 30 investors or 70 investors on a project, we can manage it fine because we got all the back office horsepower to do it. So from my perspective, we're always kind of growing our investor base. And if we can get somebody in at 25K that wouldn't have been in otherwise, they're going to see how it works and they're going to love it and they're going to come back and bring friends. So I kind of like a lower minimum. If we did a $7 or $8 million capital raise, I don't think it's going to be a 25K minimum, So we kind of take it deal by deal, but I like lower, we've experimented and I like a lower minimum, as a passive investor, I'm probably going to put in the minimum too. If I'm investing in somebody's deal and it's a 50K minimum, I'm probably going to put in 50K, and then because I personally would like to be in 4 deals instead of 2 deals if possible, So I as a passive investor, I kind of have the same approach as a lot of our passive investors. So, I do tend to skew towards a lower minimum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. What's been your experience on the raising capital side? Is there a different approach for when you guys have, a C-class heavy value add project versus, a super stable A-class property that might have lower returns, but is, more predictable cash flow and maybe a little bit less of an upside? Those are two different types of investors. So do you have a different approach for raising that capital or is it kind of similar?
All of our projects have been similar return projections, in that 15 to 20% average annualized return projection. So let's say it's a 17% average annualized return projection. Kind of all of our multifamily projects have looked like that. And what I've found over time is kind of like if I put on my passive investor hat, I'm investing in the person, and if I'm looking at their asset and their pro forma, it's like, okay, I'm going to check it out and make sure there's not any glaring flaws in it, but I'm investing in that person because there's going to be so many variables. There's going to be so much that happens over the course of that ownership cycle. That sponsor is really going to need to roll with the punches and have some experience and have some capital, all that stuff. So I'm investing in the person. And what I've found is people are doing the same with us. They're looking at us going, yeah, listen, this deal was a little bit newer or whatever. And this, we did a deal, the one I just sold that I mentioned. We did a year of first year, no pref, no distributions because it was 75% occupied when we bought it. We took it down to 50 and then filled it back up. So I thought I was going to get some real pushback on that. Nobody seemed to care. They said, hey, we're investing in you. We trust you to execute this business plan and at least deliver on your pro forma. And that's what they're investing in. So I kind of feel like my sense of it is people just almost don't really care. They're investing in our firm and in my ability to pull it off. And that's kind of how I treat my passive investments too. Now there might be somebody on a crowdfunding platform that's completely like investing sight unseen and doesn't know the sponsor where they're probably going to dig in a bit more on that. Totally understandable. I think that what we've done is just built really more of an investor network based off friends and then growing to referrals and stuff like that. And so you know, I found that if we're projecting the returns, that's kind of what people are looking at. And of course, there's going to be questions around the business plan and this and that. But for the most part, I think people are looking at the firm to invest in and what the return projection is, and whether, you know, how you get there is not, in my experience, from the passive investor's perspective, is not as important as can this sponsor do what they're setting out to do.
Right. That makes sense. And you guys have obviously executed both business models. You have a track record. So yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. I did want to add, you know, I think personally, if I'm looking for a 16% average annualized return and I can get it on a much cleaner, easier property, absolutely, I want to do that all day long. Right. But the market is not such that I just wake up in the morning and go, okay, let's get a 200 unit. Let's do it. You know, it's not that easy. So sometimes I just have to take stuff that's not ideal in order to close deals, you know? So just wanted to clarify that if the return's the same, I'll take easier work all day long if we can get it, but it's not always the case.
It's that time of the show for a segment called Best Deal, Worst Deal, where we talk about real estate transactions that you've done in the past so that others can learn from your knowledge and expertise. So Devin, with that said, what's the best real estate deal that you've done?
I got to say, it's probably been some land deals, you know,
buying
and selling land. Yeah. Okay. Just to go off the beaten path here. In my experience, there's nothing to it. And
yeah, that's how I started too. Just upstate New York, buying and selling land.
Nice. Okay. So I think that's just kind of fresh on my mind. We just exited one. That was great. I found myself over time less proud of these huge turnaround. Starting out, I was real proud of that, right? Hey, we took this junker and made it amazing. And I almost don't care now. You know, it's like I proved it to myself. Great. Who cares? What's going to get us an awesome return for our investors? It's kind of all I care about now. So I like some of the land deals. You know, the multifamily stuff has all been good. It's all been great returns, beat pro formas. So now, some of the work's been super difficult, but we've never lost any money for anybody, right? And we've never not delivered on pro forma. So I would say worst deal, you know, there's been some flips that have just been disasters, right? And I've personally lost 20, 30 grand on them. And that stinks, right? All that work to lose money. There's a house that we did that was a complete disaster. Contractor was awful. And I got so in the hole with it, I just refinanced it. And it's a short-term rental now. And I know in a few years, it'll pay for it. I just couldn't bear selling it and losing money. So I refinanced it. I've got a lot. I've probably got $50,000 of my own cash stuck in the deal. But I know I'll get it back. It just might take 5-7 years of appreciation.
When did you buy that deal?
I was probably like 2-3 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Awesome. So just going back real quick, we talked about that worst deal with the house, but we didn't get specific with the best deal. Was there a deal that you were thinking of specifically that was just like, you know, you flipped it or whatever and the returns were great? Can you speak to a specific project?
Yeah, so we just sold a deal last month that was 130 units, and it was definitely a success. We had a pretty big task. You know, we bought it. It was 106 units. We converted it to 130 units, which was kind of crazy. But it was initially built as 130 units, so we kind of converted it back. That was the immediate value add. We had about $200K in utilities that the property was paying. So we converted the property from all bills paid and a lot of Section 8 and kind of a rough property into a market property with the residents paying utilities. And what we did was we actually did a real nice renovation, probably $4,000 or $5,000 door interior renovation, but we didn't raise the rents. You know, so if rent was $750 unrenovated, it's still $750 for renovated, but you got to pay your water bill. Maybe it's $100 a month, you know, all the utilities. So mm-hmm. We were able to effectively shift that $200K a year over to the residents, and that dramatically improved our NOI. And so we turned it from 106 units to 130. We shifted over the utilities, rebranded, you know, created some pops of color in there and solar screens, and we're able to sell it inside. I think it was like 2.2 years, something like that. And got a good return for everybody. So that was nice because that was one of my first projects that I was kind of running the whole show on. Right. So it was nice to go full cycle, get everybody their money back, make everybody money and beat our average annualized return projection, and then sell. And so, and we sold it during COVID and all this crazy stuff. So it was kind of like a, an accomplishment to do that. I credit our property management team for a lot of work. That was a third party property management company for doing just a lot of that day to day on kind of a tougher property, right? So that was a big win, cleaning it up, shifting it from all bills paid to a market property, adding units, and rebranding and exiting, you know. And so that that wasn't a layup by any means, but it was definitely a success. And you know, stuff like that just kind of sets our company up for continued success, because we've got happy investors. They're going to reinvest that capital. It puts a lot of capital into our company to go, you know, continue doing what we do. And so I think the key there was just getting the right team in place, you know, especially with the on-site. Definitely went over budget on some capital items. And that's just going to happen on these 70s vintage properties. So I think it's important for your sponsor to be relatively liquid, right? And have some liquidity, because the last thing you want to do is have a sponsor do a capital call if you're doing these kind of rougher properties with bigger rehabs. So we took care of a lot of issues on that 2+ years on that property, and all's well that ends well. So that was a big win.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a great tip too about doing the renovations and then instead of raising rents, just shifting those utilities bills over to the tenants. That's yeah, that's a great approach.
I don't think we, you know, we would have raised rents if we could. It's just the market didn't really bear it, but it did bear that that utility shift. And, you know, it all flows to NOI. So it's effectively a rent increase, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Awesome. Well, Devin, we're a little bit short on time here, but I'd love to end with just one final question. You know, you've mentioned being a passive investor yourself several times. Is there any approach that you can recommend for the listeners as far as choosing markets, identifying sponsors? You know, you mentioned that a big part of your strategy is the trust and the relationship you have with the sponsor. What tips do you have for someone to get started as a passive investor to, you know, choose a sponsor to work with?
Yeah, that's a really important question. For me personally, it's I'm kind of cheating because I do this all day, every day. And so I really know people well because this is what I do. So for me to find partners to passively invest with is easy because I've committed kind of, you know, my life's work to it. If somebody is a busy professional and they're not going to do that, they don't want to go out and be an operator, I like getting on people's lists. Reach out, get on their list, see what their marketing looks like. You know, if their marketing's trash, you know, it's like right out of the gate. Geez, I mean, they didn't even put any effort into their marketing. You know, it's like, how's the rest of the business look, right? I think you get a feel for a person, an operator, or a firm just by kind of getting on their list, you know, and having a 15-minute conversation with them, and then just start to build, you know, a little stable of sponsors to just start following. It doesn't mean you need to place capital immediately. I, you know, it's a relationship. So, and now it's so easy to just find some people on the internet, get on their lists, and just start following along. You know, and you'll start to see who you align with in terms of values and investment philosophy and stuff like that. And you can start growing that kind of list of sponsors in very few minutes a week, and just start growing that. Don't be in a hurry, and just start, you know, always continue to educate yourself and just start following people, and you'll start to see patterns emerge and start to gravitate towards certain groups over others.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm curious for you specifically, are you looking at other markets as far as when you invest passively? Oh, you're staying in San Antonio?
Oh, passively, sure. Yeah, sure. It's all about the deal sponsor for me. So yeah. And of course, market selection to an extent is important. Like I want to be obviously in a landlord friendly state. You know, I don't want to invest in Portland, but if it's landlord friendly state and it's a sponsor I like, and if I like the sponsor, they're doing the market selection. You know what I mean? So I'm definitely relying on them. I like to be a passive, you know, and let them do the work. So it's definitely for me, my personal philosophy is sponsor first, relationship first. And I'm assuming if I'm going to invest with them that they're doing all that market research, et cetera. So, I mean, my experience is there's just so many variables, you know, in a property when you get in and start operating it. I don't think the market is going to, there's a handful, I think, of good, growing, landlord-friendly markets. And if it's one of those, great, you know, that's fine for me.
Devin, where can people go to learn more about what you're up to and connect and maybe join your list?
Yeah, it's the easiest spot would just be the main website. That's djetexas.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for being here. I appreciate you taking the time and enjoy the rest of your day.
Awesome, Mark. Thanks for having me on. We'll see you.
Hey everybody, it's Mark Allen Kenny. If you're interested in apartment building investments, schedule a call with me so we can have a chance to chat. My company is focused on growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. So let's hop on a quick call and talk about your investment goals and see if we're a good fit. Find out more at stellarinvestmentgroup.com.